Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 436, recorded October 12th, 2017. NVIDIA GTX 1070 Ti, it's like a $400 1080.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by WordPress. Your customers want to find you. Build a WordPress.com website and help them connect with your business. Get 15% off any new plan purchase at WordPress.com/Twitch. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Go to ring.com/Twitch and get up to $150 off of a Ring of Security kit. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/Twitch.
Welcome to Twits, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twits weekly show that aims to bring you, hey, the biggest, the bestest, the most important news in computer hardware, whether it's desktop, laptop, mobile, virtual, mayhem, dogs, cats, the occasional server. Well, actually, we don't talk about dogs or cats usually, but we do occasionally talk about servers. I'm Patty Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Schrout. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm feeling for our friends up in Petaluma, because I'm 40 miles south of them, give or take, and the air is gray and thick, and because about 107,000, well, as of yesterday, 107,000 acres. Who knows how many acres are on fire in the North Bay at this point? But like 2,000 plus structures have burned, tens of thousands of people have been displaced. The air is full of stuff. It's not just your classic forest fire where you just got to deal with wood smoke. It's burning insulation and mayhem, and man, there's some funny smells going on these days. So, you know, we talk about it a lot on Tech Thing. We talk about it occasionally on Twitch. Back up. 3, 2, 1. Three copies, two different mediums, at least one off-site, because, you know, when things go horrendously wrong, your house may be gone and everything inside of it, which happened to a friend of mine's, most of a friend of mine's neighborhood. Props to him for being in his backyard with a shovel and a hose and maintaining things until the firefighters made it. But goodness, it has been a rough year for natural disasters all over the place. On that bright and cheerful note, Ken over at PC Pur got to take a trip to Japan and got a peek inside of Lenovo's Yamato ThinkPad testing laboratory. I just want to say laboratory in the British sense, because this just sounds like, you know, I'm mentally picturing like little zappy noises going up from, you know, Jacob's ladders in the background. But the reality is it's probably pretty clean, pretty quiet. And what are they doing there, man?
So this is basically one of their outlets for kind of eval and testing of these devices. If you go if you scroll through it, you get a pretty good description and overview of kind of like what they're testing on these designs. Obviously, they're not testing every individual machine that is produced, but they'll take designs and run these through the ringer of, you know, static, shock, interference, sound, noise, pressure from opening and closing the screen over and over and over again, drop tests, which are, you know, if you watch those little short clip videos, extremely violent and disheartening to watch, is it basically looks like PC murder as it happens. You know, they have these machines running in freezers, they have them running in heat, in hot boxes, trying to test the capabilities of these devices back and forth. And it's really interesting every once in a while. Like, you know, I've seen some of these before. I'm sure Ken has kind of known about these before, but it's interesting every once in a while to get a feel for how far some of these companies go to really evaluate their products. So here you can just see a ThinkPad. It's just going to have a flat drop, right? And there's another one where it gets dropped on its corner. Yeah, this next one right here. Which is, you know, the most feeling you get. There it goes.
Ow!
Oh. Yeah, it's rough. It's rough. And then they go into somewhere. They do like electrostatic discharge onto the keyboard or into the USB port. Even those types of things. Like they do, they go through a lot of this different stuff. And what's interesting is not that Lenovo's is X times better than the others or not or whatever. It's just I think from a consumer standpoint, a lot of times we don't appreciate the amount of resources that go into developing some of this stuff and into kind of perfecting some of this type of thing. Even the ones like there, you can see the opening and closing. I just like that there are robots to do this as well. They just open and close these hinges 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Notice that they pause as well, so there's no artificial generation of heat that might affect the process. And then this one is just like simulating what I like to call the baby test, which is where there's just a kid with their knee on the center of your screen, right? So like they just crawl over it or walk over it or do whatever. And how well does the screen respond to those types of tests? But I think what I was trying to say is from a consumer standpoint, it's just good to know that these things are happening, right? And it doesn't happen to everything, right? And it's to different degrees. I have been able to tour Dell's rugged laboratory where they go way further than even what Lenovo is doing here. Because they're fully rugged, they're waterproof, they're dustproof, they're ingress-proof, they're way higher distance rated drop-proof.
Well, these are also rugged laptops you're talking about that are designed to be in the filth and the mayhem and the construction sites and police cruisers and military, deployments, which you would think they might be held to a higher standard of testing than something.
And they should
be. Goes from your desk to your laptop bag to the airport to the desk at the remote facility.
I just think we've both of us have talked about in various instances, like, hey, we have this affinity and this affection towards ThinkPad laptops. And for what reason, right? It's hard to put into words, like, well, the keyboard's really nice, but the performance, the screens, other than the OLED, like you can get that in other places. It's this type of stuff that I think really helps them stand out. I have thrown two different ThinkPad notebooks across concrete in the last 4 or 5 years, right? And both of them have survived. They had scratches on them. One of them was made accidentally. Okay. One of them I had, it was a backpack with a side zipper, and I had accidentally left the side zipper open, and I like tossed it over my shoulder, tossed the bag over my shoulder. And when the backpack stopped, the laptop did not, and it kept going out the side zipper of the bag. And it was made out of magnesium, and it like dented, it hit right on the corner of it too, like the worst possible spot. And it was using a spinning hard drive, I think, at that point too. But turned it on, booted, all the data was there, no issues, right? And those are, worst case scenarios for consumers and the environments that they should be in. But that's kind of how you want to plan. And it's, wouldn't you like to see what they do on these cell phones in comparison? Like, let's see, does Apple do drop tests on their new designs? And if so, what are the results? What do they look like, right? Does the Note 8, how drop resistant is that, and so it's nice every once in a while just to see, even though these aren't quote unquote rugged laptops, that they get beat up and they're okay with that a little bit, right?
It's hard out there for a laptop. Let's be honest. This is an incredibly complicated, sophisticated collection of actually not particularly robust electronics that is somehow enwrapped, enclosed, encased in a fairly sophisticated framework that allows it to not flex, bend, break, disintegrate under what more often than not is probably some alarming use. I was talking to a friend of mine not less than an hour ago, and he's like, I noticed my laptop was creaking. And I looked and the screws were loose. I'm like, yeah, it happens. That's why some vendors actually use the equivalent of blue Loctite on their screws to help increase the bond between, the screw and the socket to keep it from loosening up over time. Having a rigid enough enclosure so that it flexes less so the screws don't fall out. But you know, it's a lot of little things have to go right for a laptop to work well. And even more things have to go right for that laptop to still be working in 3 or 4 years. So props, you know, to ThinkPad. And you know, I think we mentioned it last week. Congratulations on the 25th anniversary of the ThinkPad brand. Keep going.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness. The unofficial launch of the GTX 1070 Ti Tech ARP, I guess, put together a compilation of all the leaks. Jeremy wrote this up at PCPer.com. You know, technically, it hasn't been released yet, but the information has been coming out slowly but slowly. October 26th is the scheduled launch date. The MSRP is $429, which means, once again, I'm feeling that much more irritated about my purchase of a 1070 a couple months ago to test 8K monitors. Because not only is there the AMD 56, Vega 56, which I can't buy anywhere, so I don't feel so bad about that. But there's now a 1070 Ti, both of which will fall within like $25 of what I paid for my 1070 and outperform it. Because, you know, why not? Huge jump in CUDA cores, as far as I'm concerned, from GTX 1070s at 1920 CUDA cores. You're bumping this up like another 512 on the 1070 Ti. Clock speeds, base clock 1607, overclock 1683 megahertz. Texture fill rate goes up significantly, you know, from 180 to 202, or like basically from like 202 to 255. GT per second. Pixel fill rate is not particularly huge. The maximum pixel fill rate is pretty much the same on the 1070 and 1070 Ti. They both run 8 gigabytes of GDDR5. They both have 256 gigabytes per second of memory bandwidth. But generally speaking, it should outperform the 1070. And with that, with the increase in CUDA cores on that, it should handily outperform the 1070, I would think.
Yeah.
Is it going to be a brutal difference? Am I going to be really pissed when I see the benchmarks?
Hey, it all depends on what your mentality is that day.
thanks.
You know, so it's clearly going to be much closer to the 1080 than it is the 1070, right? A drastic increase in core count. The clock, the base clock speeds match. The boost clock speeds are within 50 megahertz to the 1080. It's gonna be really interesting to see how NVIDIA creates space here for this product to exist, right? Because if it's close enough to the 1080, and if we go, let's pretend video cards sell at the price they're supposed to today. The 1080 is supposed to be $499. And the 1070 is supposed to be $399. In theory, that gives you a 1070 Ti somewhere in the middle there, split the difference, $449. But it's going to be much closer and perf to that $499 card. Now, all this comes down to what will the prices actually be? What will the inventory, what will the availability actually be? Coin mining is still ruining everything as far as I'm concerned. And this is going to be faster. Core count memories or faster core count and clock speeds while still using the lower latency GDDR5 memory that the 1070 uses, not the higher frequency, longer latency of the GDDR5X that the 1080 uses. So like it's a mining card dream for that particular reason, right? So
availability, it may even be a complete nightmare.
That would be my guess at this point. Yes. But even in an ideal world, which is kind of where if you're NVIDIA, AMD, or Intel, or whatever, you kind of have to plan your product portfolio based on if all of this mining crap stopped tomorrow, what would we be left with? So I'm interested to see if the 1070 maybe drops a little bit in price, like it goes down to like $379 or $369, and now the 1070 Ti goes into the $449 space or something like that, right? And that would make a little bit more sense to me in terms of broadening this and then still keeping the GTX 1070 as a relevant part to compete against the Vegas 56 part if and when it becomes regularly available. But it, honestly, I'm surprised that they're doing this. I'm still kind of shocked that they are releasing that this product, right? They don't really need to. They could have waited for the mining stuff to kind of die down a little bit and then released it when people actually had the flexibility to buy product. I don't know. But they just don't like the idea that the GTX 1070, in that ideal perfect world, the GTX 1070 is beat by the Vega 56 in terms of performance per dollar. And they didn't want to be in that position anymore. So
yeah, I'm not entirely sure I understand the decision either, but who knows? Maybe they've spent months stockpiling millions of them and they plan to take over the entire space and keep it at MSRP or better, despite tremendous demands of the coin miners. This is me not holding my breath, but you know, what a lovely gift that would be for all of us.
Agreed.
Oh my goodness. Bunch more coming up in the show, including some envision, if you will, hard drives beyond 40 terabytes. Just savor that for a moment. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by WordPress. We know that building something new, something that others connect with, is a lot easier with the right tools. Ask me, I've used the wrong tools to build a website, and I can tell you about the pain. That's why we're excited to have WordPress.com as a sponsor. I use WordPress.com every day, and let me tell you, whether you're looking to create a personal blog, a business website, or both, creating your site on WordPress.com helps others find you, remember you, and connect with you. You don't need experience. You don't need to hire someone. You don't need to pay a fortune. WordPress.com guides you through the entire process. They have hundreds of beautiful designs to choose from. You get built-in search engine optimization and social sharing. Their business plan gives you access to hundreds of plugins and themes. That is so nice. You choose a WordPress.com plan, and you get a lively community where you'll have access to expert-friendly support. It's so sweet. Come and see why 28% of all websites run on WordPress, the web's most popular and most powerful site building platform. Do yourself a favor. Get started today with 15% off any new plan purchase. Go to WordPress.com/Twitch to create your website and find the plan that's right for you. That's WordPress.com/TWICH for 15% off your brand new website. And we thank WordPress for their support. Good stuff, people. We teased it. MAMR Tech. I'm going to call it MAMR because it just makes me feel like I'm in a video game. Western Digital say this is what's going to push hard disk drives beyond 40 terabytes. Now, Alan's talked about a whole bunch of ways of increasing the density of hard disk drive storage, which is still valid and important because not everything needs to be on an SSD. And to scale things, like imagine, if you will, a couple hundred acres under one roof filled with hard drives. And what you have pretty much described there is either A, a government three-letter facility that's recording all of our phone conversations, or B, a Facebook data warehouse where they put all of the GIFs and pictures that people rarely click on. They basically store them in massive, low-cost off-site facilities where they literally have to sort of bring the drive up to speed to rip that GIF off when you're looking at a conversation from 5 years ago. but this is you're laughing, but I've seen one of these facilities. They're huge, and they are full of cat GIFs. That's my theory. The secret Oregon location of the cat GIFs. You know, Alan certainly talked about heat-assisted magnetic recording. Quote, forever so, looming on the horizon, just out of reach.
A little snarky there. I went to this meeting as well. I attended it, and that's why I was in San Jose this week. And what was interesting to me is I didn't really know what HAMR was what they call it. I didn't know what MAMR was and what the differences between these two different things were. Essentially, they're both trying to overcome the same problem, which is the ability to write to hard drives in more and more dense configurations is significantly more difficult than it used to be. So your density per square inch essentially is what you're trying to get to. And Alan did an excellent write-up, and there's some slides in here from some really, really smart people from one of the professors at Carnegie Mellon that did a lot of this research and stuff. The method that had been talked about over the last couple of years to get past this current rut that the hard drive industry was entering in terms of capacity was heat assisted, where they actually basically a laser shines onto the platter, heats up those particular areas that need to be flipped magnetically in order to assist it to flip and stay stable. Right. The problems with that were it was it caused potential stability issues, long-term stability issues, because you're heating up portions of this platter up to like 700 degrees Celsius, and they didn't really know
what that
was going to do to the long. That's really, really hot. They didn't know what that was going to do to reliability. You had to design new materials, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The MAMR is microwave-based, and it's essentially doing the same thing. It's helping the magnetic flipping of the bit essentially on the hard drive, but it does it with existing materials without any temperature adjustments necessary. It's all done through a microwave resonance field, right? And this is something that right now only Western Digital has developed, right? It's a technology that has been discussed since like 2009 in research papers and whatnot, but only Western Digital has really figured out the keys to getting it done. So they think they're going to have a 2 to 3 year advantage on implementing this technology before any of their competition, which in reality, there's Seagate, which is the other major hard drive player, then Toshiba is still in there a little bit as well. So what the benefit to Western Digital is now they have a roadmap forward for higher density hard drives that they didn't really have before, that nobody had a lot of confidence in. So, you know, we've got 14 terabyte hard drives today, I think, yeah. And I think Seagate just yesterday, not a coincidence, kind of said, hey, we're going to have a 16 terabyte in the next year using existing technology. Mm-hmm. Western Digital showed in their slides like, hey, by 2025, which is 7 years away, we're going to have 40 terabyte drives. And we have room to go beyond that
drop
with this. Yeah. Yeah. And on existing technology, they think that caps out at 20 by 2025. So what's interesting is we're getting more density. You're going to get, you know, performance won't change that much on hard drives. Like you're not going to like random seek is actually going to be maybe slower on average because head speeds and rotational speeds aren't going to change, but the amount of data that exists is sequential performance will go up a little bit just because of aerial density improvements. Right. Most interesting thing is if you look at the very, very last slide that he has there, which is hard drive versus flash SSD annual takedown trend. Everybody had been predicting that SSDs would cross over a cost benefit with hard drives at some point because hard drives had hit this kind of wall of density increases or a severe slowdown on density increases. And Western Digital now says that that's not the case, right? People had predicted that essentially by 2025 or 2024 that flash would be as cheap or near enough to hard drives in terms of cost per gigabyte that we would see massive adoption of flash because of its performance benefits. Now they believe that 10x difference in cost per gigabyte will extend into 2030 and beyond, probably, because of this capability that they developed with the microwave assisted recording stuff, right? So, it was like, you know, we kind of went out there, and honestly, I had no idea what to expect. I was like, what is Western Digital bringing me out here to show me a 16 terabyte drive for? This is not a big deal, but they really fundamentally think they have changed the next 13 to 15 years of hard drive roadmaps because of this. So hard drives aren't going anywhere, and the insatiable need to store data is not going anywhere, right? Like we're all taking more pictures, we're all taking more video and higher quality and all that type of stuff, and we never want to get rid of any of it ever, period. End of discussion. So hard drives will continue to see. No, I don't. I think we need way, way better ways of organizing it and searching through it before it becomes useful. But the storage of it obviously will need to continue for the foreseeable future. So that's pretty much what Western Digital announced. Now, they're not going to ship any of these drives until 2019. And they'll probably start at the same capacity that wherever their standard perpendicular recording media is at there, but they will be able to increase it over the next years much, much quicker than they would otherwise. So if you like hard drives that store a lot of data for your NAS devices and or you run cloud server farms, this is important information for you.
Absolutely. Good read up at PCPer.com and worth taking a moment to check out. While we're on the storage beat, the shipments of hard and solid-state disk drives worldwide from 2015 to 2021 in millions. Oh, my goodness. So 2015, you were looking at 470 million hard drives and 105 million SSDs. And currently in 2017, we're looking at probably 400 million, 395 to be more exact with the statistics for the estimated sales, 395 million hard drives, 190 million SSDs. And by 2021, hard disk drive sales will be on the decline, in part perhaps because each individual hard drive is so delete expletive big, and in part because SSD capacity and price should be at the same level or lower than traditional hard disk drives. But we're looking at like 360 million SSDs in 2021 versus 330 million hard drives. This is a projection, if you will, or as Statista likes to say, estimates suggest that shipments of hard disk drives will decline, falling to 395 million units shipped in 2017. I also love their definition. In case you're not familiar with the statistics in question, quote, hard disk drives, HDD, are data storage devices used for storing and retrieving digital information. They are non-volatile memory, meaning that they retain data even when unpowered. The main competing technology for secondary storage is flash memory in the form of solid-state drives. Currently, HDDs generally offer greater recording capacity, a better price per unit of storage, and a longer product lifetime, while SSDs are faster, generally more durable, and consume less power. So,
what I found interesting about this, I found interesting about these stats in relation to what the news we just talked about, this data can still be accurate. We'll still sell more flash, but in terms of the percentage of storage that exists in hard drive form versus flash form. It will still, I think Western Digital estimated in 2025 in the data center, it will still be 90% hard drives, right? So even if we're shipping more quantity of flash drives, which makes sense as we see that take over in consumer spaces and mobile spaces and everything in between, and maybe even added into enterprise applications as caches, even if they don't need super high performance all the time, the capacity of hard drives is still going to increase at a stellar rate. So it'll be interesting for me to see over the next couple of months, I guess, maybe even a quarter or two, how some of these stats get adjusted based on Western Digital's claim. Because if what they said they can do, they actually, people believe they'll be able to do, might shift some of these numbers in interesting ways.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. I don't know. I'm the thing that kind of, because we spend so much of our time talking to people who are enthusiasts or are power computing or need all of the capacity and all of the speed because they're video editing, there's this sort of idea that, what? People still buy hard disk drives? And it's like, yes. Yes, they do. Nearly twice as many hard disk drives are going to be sold this year as solid state drives. And it's going to take a while, literally another 3+ years for that to reach parity. It's also really interesting to look as you start digging through the Statista website, Statista.com. They've got like quarterly market share held by NAND flash memory manufacturers worldwide from 2010 to 2017. And it's really interesting to sort of watch, Samsung's, pretty much been at 35 to 40% of the market for a while. Toshiba's gone from 35% of the NAND market to less than 20%, about 17.5%. It's a volatile world out there. Micron's, still sitting, Micron's down about, they've been pretty consistent at 13% for a while, but SK Hynix is down in the single digits. I just say, you know, it's interesting to sort of look at all of these stats. They have smartphone market share by vendor, revenue of Samsung Electronics, global LCD TV manufacturer market share from 2008 to 2016. You know, it's amazing to realize how often a single company just radically dominates a market. I mean, Samsung's got, you know, 21% of the LCDs sold in 2016. LG's at 11.9%, TCL's 9%, Sony's 5.6%, Hisense 6.1%. Now, that's not all televisions sold, right? That doesn't include OLEDs and other things, but it's very, you know, it's interesting. It gives you an interesting perspective on how markets work and where they're going. Although you will need a premium account at $50 a month to get access to all of the shiny cool stuff. Should you be out there looking for that one? Oh my goodness. We should take a moment to thank our second sponsor in this episode of Twitch, the fine people at Ring, the Ring Video Doorbell. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. Ring's mission is to make neighborhoods safer. Today, over a million people, including Mr. Ryan Shrout, use the amazing Ring Video Doorbell to help protect their homes, and in Ryan's case, his home and his business. Ring knows home security begins at the front door, but it doesn't end there, which is why they're extending that same level of security to the rest of your home with the Ring Floodlight Cam. Just like Ring's video doorbell, Floodlight Cam is a motion-activated camera and floodlight that connects to your phone. HD video, two-way audio, you know the moment anyone steps on your property. See and speak to visitors, set off an alarm right from your phone. You are on it, people. And with the Floodlight Cam, when things go bump in the night, you'll immediately know what it is. Is it a raccoon? Is it that neighbor kid? All you got to do is pick up your phone. Doesn't matter if you're home or away, the Ring Floodlight Cam lets you keep an eye on things going on back at the house. Ring Floodlight Cams offer the ultimate in home security with high visibility floodlights and a powerful HD camera that puts security in your hands. Named the Wall Street Journal's Best of CES 2017. It's a nice thing to be able to say for the Ring Video Doorbell. Monitor every corner of your property with a Ring security kit. All kits include a Ring Video Doorbell and your choice of either 1, 2, or 3 floodlight cams. You can connect your Ring Video Doorbell with your favorite smart locks and hubs for added convenience, monitoring, and security. People, with Ring, you are always home. Save up to $150 on a Ring of Security kit when you go to ring.com/Twitch. That's ring.com/TWICH. And we want to thank Ring for their support. And I think Ryan wants to thank them for helping to keep his business and his family safe.
Indeed.
Amen. It's good stuff. Virtual reality, wherever you want to take it. Interesting week for Oculus. Because what I'm about to talk about is the Oculus Go. The Oculus Rift pricing has been permanently set at $399, which I am hoping is going to cause HTC to make a significant drop in the HTC Vive price, because I'm still holding out for an HTC Vive. But yeah, $399 for the Oculus Rift. And then...
Yep.
In 2018, early 2018, starting at $199, effortlessly enter VR with no PC or wires attached. Oculus Go, the all-in-one VR headset made to fit you. Which apparently means the Oculus Rift isn't made to fit you, which doesn't make any sense to me, but I had to say it. We've also got Santa Cruz. Is Santa Cruz the next generation Oculus Rift or another all-in-one, you know... self-powered, yeah, managed, processed headset from the crew at Oculus.
So both the Oculus Go, which is an actual product now that has a release date a release window of early 2018, and the Oculus Project Santa Cruz are self-contained VR headsets, right? So they're both Qualcomm Snapdragon based hardware. It doesn't require a PC. The Santa Cruz itself, though, I don't think it's been productized yet. I don't think they finalized that it's where it's going to be, what it's going to be priced at, that type of thing. I think they're still doing research on it. So its place as the successor to the Rift is still kind of in question, right? because it's, I mean, it's clearly going to have significantly less compute power than your PC would have. That being said, maybe the Rift and the Vive guys have seen that there isn't a huge uptick for, you know, tethered VR systems.
Right.
And even though what I desperately want is much higher resolution screens, less screen door effect, better optics, better external inside out tracking on a PC attached one, that may not be in the cards quite yet. The Oculus Go is 109. Yeah.
I was going to say, like, HTC's working, like, you know, I think it was GSM Arena says that HTC Vive, or HTC has registered a trademark for Vive Eclipse, which they think is the next generation VR headset. We've got on the, you know, HTC's website, I feel confident in saying, very prematurely announced, based on the staggering amount of rendered experiences on the Vive webpage for the HTC Vive standalone. You know, one of the side effects of reviewing products for a long time is people be like, look, it's the new widget. And you're like, look, it's a 3D render of something that probably doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, when you have lots of language like be free to be whoever you are, be free to wander, watch, play, and create in Vive standalone VR. You know, which oddly enough appears to be a daydream experience rather than, say, more what we were thinking of the PC. But, you know, there's lots of activity here, or there's lots of marketing noises, because everybody's trying to keep the revenue going until the next big thing becomes more affordable.
I think this new Vive kit is going to be, you know, mobile based, like a Snapdragon based system. It will be daydream ish, probably with their own wrapper of store and ecosystem, right? And I think everybody's kind of understood that this freestanding VR is kind of what people really want. Mm-hmm. I would argue that they will struggle to keep up with the quality of experience that you could get on the PC still, but it's the ease of install and the ease of adoption and use is just dramatic. The Oculus Go at $199 is also really cheap, right? Considering you don't need to buy a phone for it. I mean, heck, how much does the Google, like just the headset itself cost? It's like $69, right? Or something like that for the one that you add a cell phone to. So the Oculus Go is kind of like the lower end. It's powered by an older chip, the Snapdragon 821, whereas the Santa Cruz is powered by the Snapdragon 835. And so you will be able to get different levels of graphics and performance, and the 835 supports some better DSP processing that allows it to do perform six DOF functions, which is maybe the least friendly term for 6 degrees of freedom, where you can walk and move and turn and rotate and duck and all, you know, and basically anything you could do, it's able to track. So the Go is really, it's the entry level. The Santa Cruz is probably the competitor to the Vive system we were talking about, where they're trying to aim for this premium tier of product, while also still being freestanding, you know, non-tethered devices. I'm a little disappointed we haven't seen anybody else really come up with or talk about Y-Gig or like a wireless headset that is still attached to a PC. That was Intel's big thing, but they kind of backed out of that.
Y-Gig seems to have kind of crashed and burned.
Yeah. Which is...
Or bad. Just disappeared like, off the roadmap.
Yeah, and there were even, you know, earlier this year and last year, there were, you know, guys at CES showing accessories that were like, hey, we figured out how to make the Vive untethered, right? And we haven't seen those take off. I don't see people talking about those aren't for sale in any kind of retail thing. They were, you know, available in sale through China or through Kickstarter, but nothing else kind of beyond that. And so it seems like the bet is moving towards these freestanding you know, Snapdragon based or whatever mobile chip based devices because of their benefits in mobility and power consumption and all that good stuff and cost, obviously, as well.
Something that, you know, was kind of interesting to me as the bargain shopper is, you know, you can't seem to find an Oculus Rift for sale on any venues where you won't pay a sales tax or, you know, if you...
here in California, right, we got to pay sales tax on Amazon and Newegg. But it's funny, like you can go to B&H Photo and buy an HTC Vive. And if you're outside of New York and New Jersey, you can buy it for $599 and save yourself like $50 on sales tax. And the Oculus Rift is not available anywhere. You can't do the sales tax, but you do get that $399 price now. You know, the HTC Vive still sitting at $599. I like the controllers better on the HTC Vive. Are you feeling more love for the Oculus Rift controls, or?
I still think the Vive is the better overall system. I think the controls feel snappier and sharper, for whatever that means, like the laser tracking versus the camera tracking, I think, is just more precise, right? And you can feel that. Right. Now, it's not a huge difference for the price that you can get a Rift and touch controllers for now is amazing, right? I think, so if they dropped it to $399 permanently, I think, so that's, is that $499 permanently with the controllers, or is that $399 permanently with the controllers?
I am looking at Amazon.com Oculus Rift Plus Touch Virtual Reality System. For $300, let me double check, because I thought that was permanently the Oculus Rift with the controllers. I mean,
that's,
let me double
check. That's amazing. If you have a PC that is in that qualified for VR state, then that's an awesome deal. And the Vive is significantly more expensive still. So yeah, Rift Plus Touch $399. That's pretty great, actually.
Yeah, Oculus Rift price drops terminally to $399.
You know, the good news is you can't coin mine with an Oculus Rift, so they're in stock and available.
The prototype Santa Cruz headset feels like a wireless Oculus Rift. So that's the reports coming out of the Oculus Connect show.
There's no getting around the fact that whatever, even if it's Snapdragon 835 or the next gen Snapdragon, it's nowhere near the compute power and graphics power of even like a GTX 1060, right? So you'd still, in theory, be able to do much better stuff if developers are willing to continue to spend money and time developing that stuff. I think the issue is all those first wave developers that did that realized they didn't make any money because the market is not there and the market's not growing fast enough for them to feel confident in that. Whereas in the mobile space, they again have hope because it's an unknown, right? There's still potential for it to grow very quickly as well. So I think all indications are that the mobility option is what's going to win out.
There you have it, people. Pirate Bay is mining cryptocurrency again, and there is no opt-out. If you're not kind of up to speed on this, a new and exciting way for websites to make revenue, often websites that are on the naughtier spectrum of things, where perhaps they get denied charging services or advertising, is to essentially run advertisements that take advantage of your processor to crypto mine or mine cryptocurrencies. And, you know, the CDN provider Cloudflare, torrentfreak.com notices, quote, previously suspended the account of a site that used a similar miner, which means the Pirate Bay could be next. I had a friend of mine send me to a site, which I will not mention on this family-friendly show, and I opened up a couple pages and managed to spike my significantly powerful desktop processor at 92% with two website pages,
nice. Open,
which I think is pretty impressive. I'm sure it was a great day for, you know, whatever system they use that looks at the processor it's hammering on. But, you know, I've got 8 cores and 16 threads I can run on this desktop machine. And I'm pretty sure 7 of those cores were maxed out running the cryptocurrency plugin. You know, it's JavaScript based, so you could possibly, block them by blocking JavaScript. But it's an interesting way to generate revenue.
one of the things that Torrent Freak notices is that, quote, the miner does appear to be throttled to a certain degree, so most users might not even notice that it's running, which I think is kind of the point in a lot of ways, that you generate revenue in this very peculiar fashion by doing something that may be less intrusive than 27 eye-blasting ads. It's interesting. CoinHive script. TPB. CoinHive is the cryptocurrency miner that most places are running. I'm curious. I'm very, 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 very curious about this. In my case, I opened up a couple windows and pretty much maxed out my system. And it is a powerful desktop system. And it was noticeable, to say the very least.
Yeah.
So, maybe that was a glitch in the implementation of the JavaScript, or maybe that's something more of us can look forward to. As the advertising market continues to become less predictable and less remunerative for smaller websites, perhaps more websites will start harvesting coins or working for distributed coin harvesting operations in order to make the bills meet. Qualcomm fined a record $773 million in Taiwan antitrust probe. One, I'm kind of shocked this happened in Taiwan. And two, that's a fairly big number.
It's kind of a continuing trend for them. They got hit in the EU, and they have all these legal battles going on with Apple, as well as their client customers as well. So $773 million from Taiwan's Fair Trade Commission. Violating antitrust rules for at least 7 years, they claim, during their collection of over 400 billion NT, which is the Taiwanese dollar. So they had a 23 billion NT fine over the collection of 400 billion in licensing fees. Qualcomm's going to appeal of this, of course.
Of course.
They've had scrutiny, but... Something's going to break eventually, right? Because now they've had scrutiny from regulators around the world, with practices probed in South Korea, China, Japan, the EU, and elsewhere. And plus that Apple battle. Taiwanese regulators said that it determined that Qualcomm had monopoly market status over key mobile phone standards. And by not providing products to clients who disagree or who don't agree with its conditions, the U.S. company is violating local laws. Said Taiwanese companies had purchased $30 billion worth of Qualcomm's baseband chips. So this will continue to come down to, as it did in the U.S., a battle of does Qualcomm have some kind of monopoly status because of its IP and its portfolio there? Or is it just a matter of these companies don't want to have to pay?
Well, it's not just there.
It's Qualcomm's kind of asking.
Yeah, and that's by not providing products to clients who don't agree with its conditions. Qualcomm holds a big number of standard essential patents in CDMA, WCDMA, LTE, refused to license necessary patents, the FTC said. Right, abused its advantage in mobile communications and refused to license necessary patents. And you could argue, if you were a shareholder or an officer or a lawyer for Qualcomm, that we've created these wonderful standards, or we support these wonderful standards.
I'm sure that's what they will do. Yeah. I'm sure that's what they will do. And there, I like with all these types of stuff, there's going to be 100 different angles to look at it for. It just was noteworthy to me that this was another... like ruling against them. And so I just feel like something has to halt at some point. They just need to start to settle these things or open up things in a different way or whatever it's going to be. Eventually, when you're fighting a war on like seven different fronts with seven different countries, trade groups, that's going to be trying on your counsel, internal counsel of that company.
Well,
but keep
them
employed for a very long time. Yeah.
Just hire more lawyers. it's not like there aren't enough lawyers in the world to keep busy. But at some point I wonder, is this a situation where, there's obviously a whole lot of smoke. Does this mean there's a whole lot of fire? Or is it just too messy at this point to even make any predictions on?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. There's a whole lot of smoke, but what you don't know is I think what you find happens oftentimes in these things, as soon as one person has the guts to sue, right, whether or not the suit is merited or they think they're going to win, everybody else feels like they need to be a part of it as well. So like, even, you know, Taiwan's like, we need to protect our customers and our internal companies here, right? My guess is that the Taiwan FTC gets a lot of pressure from those companies that are based in Taiwan that have been spending this money about, hey, how come South Korea is doing this and the EU is doing this, but you're not helping us with this? And so now they file suit and they do these types of things. So I think there's probably some of that in there as well. But, you know, it's getting harder for Qualcomm to claim that there's nothing amiss with their practices when this just continues to happen.
It's a theme. And we've seen this before with other massive companies that seem to hold advantages. And we wait with bated breath, ladies and gentlemen.
For a very long time. Might.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. You know what you don't have to wait for? You know, it doesn't have to be traumatic. A mortgage. This Week in Computer Hardware, brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience, not keeping up with the times, dated, needed a client-focused technological revolution, which is why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It is simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Quicken's trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. Based on your income, your assets, your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. Sounds nice, huh? Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twitch. That's rocketmortgage.com/TWICH. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. On the oops, we need a patch for that. Department. Google is permanently nerfing all home minis because mine spied on everything I said 24/7. That was the article up on Android Police. Nerfing being a highly technological term. There's been like multiple updates. One that Google has decided to permanently remove all top touch functionality. And then that Google has published a support page to address the reported issue. This is essentially Artem Rusakovsky over at Android Police. Was really excited. Went to the Google launch event in San Francisco. You know, Pixels, Pixel Buds, Google Clips, and the Home Mini, the $50 version of the Home that everybody had been expecting for a long time. And, you know, everybody got to take one home if they're at the Google launch event. And he put his in the bathroom. And, quote, "Before you go raising your eyebrows, this is a room I spend a considerable amount of time in, listening to podcast music and asking Google random questions when I get ready for the day in the morning." And also because I think he had, Amazon stuff in like every other room in his house. Apparently, unlike the other homes and echoes in his home, it was, quote, "waking up thousands of times a day, recording, and then sending those recordings to Google." Basically, the four lights on the unit were flashing on then off and nothing else. So this is a little odd. Did you get kind of deep into this one? Because it was...
I mean, a little bit, right? So the idea was that it was a malfunction where I think the idea of this push a button so that it can register rather than needing a keyword is actually useful. Right. I use it on my Amazon Echoes at the house. If I'm walking by it, I hit the button and say the command, which is all this was intended to do. But it wasn't a physical button. Right. It was a capacitive button that was malfunctioning. And so it was basically listening the whole time, sending recordings. It wasn't sending them and saving them to some database, secretly and on purpose. It was malfunctioning.
It wasn't nefarious. It was literally like
searching. Yeah.
Yeah. A long press was supposed to opt into a different set of behavior. Pre-ordered Google Home Minis are not affected, but if you got an early Google Home Mini device, the touch control mechanism, long pressing it could just unhinged recording activity could be created. Patch went out. They've basically said they've removed any activity or queries that were created by long pressing the top of a Google Home Mini between October 4th and October 7th. That's not going to be showing up in your My Activity page. And if you're nervous about this, you can go to the My Activity page and take a look at the activity that's going on for your Google Home devices. The first thing they said they were going to do is that they were going to permanently remove all top touch functionality. So... Mm.
Which I find to be a disappointing solution to it.
Yeah.
Right. Like, sorry, we're just gonna take this feature away. Now maybe they'll figure out a way to push it back in a different update or something, but I don't know.
Does it hurt you?
I mean, I don't own one of these, so I can't say for sure, but like I like the functionality on the other smart speakers I have. So it's just, kind of disappointing, especially if you bought this thinking that was a feature that you would use fairly often because you hate to say keywords to trigger, mm-hmm. your smart speakers or something like that. But, in general, the media kind of over exaggerates the kind of nefariousness, as you mentioned, right? But it also does point to a very reasonable thing that, hey, if somebody wanted to do something nefarious with this, they could absolutely easily do it and it would be very difficult for you to tell, if not impossible. So,
well, except that all your activity is reported.
Well, but I'm saying if they were trying to do it nefariously, they wouldn't save that data in your search history or whatever, right? They would just store it on some server. Right? So now it's just, it's maybe a little bit of a, oh my gosh, this is something that can happen. It didn't happen this time, but it could happen. So I my Echo sitting in the corner there. I'm sure she's listening to everything I've possibly said about her. And if it's at all negative, she'll cancel my account or something like that. Or no.
Oh my goodness. Going up. So, and this, let's make this abundantly clear again. This was only for a few thousand units, which were given out, made by Google events, which was the October 4th press event, the donut pop-up events. You can still, say, okay, that word with a lot of G's in it to pause, play, or stop. You can say, okay, G-O-O-G-L-E to start your request. Currently, the Google Home support or the Google Home Mini website support page says you can't tap on the top of the Mini to control media alarms and timers, and you can't press and hold the top of the Mini to start a request with your assistant. So I'll be curious to see if they turn that back on. Artem was actually went out of his way to commend the company's reaction and speed in delivering a fix that dealt with the problem. So props to Google for moving fast to eliminate the fear-mongering Google Home Mini Smart Fabric Rock Mayhem recording issue thing. last week on Tech Thing, I don't think I talked about it on the show, I did a review of Shure's SE215 as part of my continuing effort to find... just for fun, can I find, instead of $100 earbuds, that sound better or that I enjoy more than one Morse triple drivers? $100 being a really nice price for an amazing amount of performance for in-ear monitors. One of the things that I noticed about the SE215 is that they do a tremendous amount of background noise reduction. they're claiming numbers similar to the Edemotix, which is kind of a classic in-ear. Doesn't have the bass response I would like from an in-ear. The Edemotix, there's a tremendous amount of bass in the SE215. But I bring up the Edemotix because I used to use them in when I was working in a particular metal shop, because the Edemotix deliver 37 decibels of attenuation. They cut out a significantly greater amount of background noise than any of the professional ear protection that was stocked. So when you were grinding metal, if I used my in-ears from Edemotix, I couldn't hear anything, unlike using the regular earmuffs in the shop where I could hear the grinding and the other horrible noises. So these SE215s deliver a similar 37 dB of ambient noise, which is pretty amazing, because that also makes for a really nice experience on a plane. You can still feel the jet engines, but you're not really going to hear them because you're cutting a huge amount of noise out. It drops the background level considerably without using active noise cancellation. They were a little less detailed. The highs were a little less forward, or as I put it, I would like a little more cymbal on these, a little less bass. They're a bit bass heavy for me. The build quality on them is fantastic. Removable cables, replaceable cables. So if you've been like, I've destroyed my earbuds and I need new cables, but there's no way to solder them in, you basically unsnap the old cables and snap the new cables on. A really nice set of earbuds. They do foam earbuds. And then they also do silicone earbuds or tips for the earbuds. And, fantastic build quality. A little more bass heavy than I like, if you are into bass, these are probably the earbuds for you. And if you want to cut down background noise, these with the foam tips do as good a job of cutting out ambient noise as anything I've ever had on my ears. So I want to give a shout out to the SE215. No microphone on these, no in-cable controls. So if those are must-haves for you, these are probably not the earbuds for you. That said, or earphones as they call them, they do have replacement cables for them that include that or offer Bluetooth compatibility on that. But I was impressed. I was impressed, especially again with the amount of noise they cut out in the background. Something we talked about this week, I've been playing around with a bunch of wireless mesh home networking systems. And I spent a bunch of time. We had a viewer question. It was like, what's the difference between, a $400 mesh kit, for example, the Eero or the Eero 2, and, a $100 router or a router with an additional access point? So we got pretty deep on that in Tech Thing this week. And for me, one of the interesting things was realizing that sometimes the common sense for the best placement on a router does not actually improve. It may actually decrease your speeds on a wireless router. This may be a very peculiar situation to my house, and where sort of the stove is related, or the oven in our house is located. When you put the router in the center of the house, the stove actually makes connectivity to the back of the house a little more difficult, even for the mesh networking systems, which I thought was kind of strange, but it was an interesting learning experience for me anyway. But it was amazing to realize, because I have not been running, an Archer C7, which is kind of the classic wire cutter pick, the best router for most people. It's got fantastic 5 gigahertz speed. In the same room, running 5 gigahertz 802.11 AC, it was actually considerably, reasonably faster than the Eero 2. But when I moved to the Hell Test, which is sort of this back bedroom in our house, which traditionally has had little to no Wi-Fi, the 5 gigahertz kind of ran at 512 kilobits per second. Loading a cartoon on a web page was sort of a 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000, or refreshing a couple times. I could not actually complete the networking tests I run, and then the bandwidth was incredibly weak. Switching to 2.4 gigahertz manually from the SSID for the 5 gigahertz side of the router to the SSD for the 2.4 gigahertz side of the router got the speeds up to about 50 megabits per second, which was comparable to the Eero system when the Eero was in the poor location in the center of the house, but about 30% slower than the Eero if the Eero was in the bad location at the front of the house with the different location for the Eero beacons or their little satellite devices that came out with the version 2, which would deliver 70 to 90 megabits per second. But again, the thing that's an advantage about a mesh router, if you're thinking like, it's so much money, you know, well, yes, it will cover parts of your house and you will not have to manually switch between networks, you know, because you want the faster 5 gigahertz speed in the front of the house and the 2.4 gigahertz that actually reaches to the back of the house. And, oh, yeah, there's a lot of wireless access points that are designed as extensions for a wireless router, but many of them don't have the ability to automatically switch between, or some of the ones I've tested in the past. If you go from the big router connected to the internet to the, you know, remote router, that's your sort of, you know, I'm bringing the Wi-Fi to the part of the house that doesn't have Wi-Fi. The thing about the mesh is it does a fairly seamless transition between those two. It may take 30 seconds or a minute to be like, oh, I want to be on this one back here, but it does it all in the background, which is really nice, especially if you have a large house and you have to deal with people like, the internet doesn't work back here. It's like, oh, well, you've got to switch to the 2.4 gigahertz. What's that 2.4 gigahertz? Oh, God. So, you know, yes, the mesh routers are considerably more expensive than a $100 router, but it may solve problems for you or just make your home tech support situation easier. It's kind of the executive summary of that. If you want to hear sort of the all of the numbers, go over to techthing.com and take a look at that. If you want to get all of Ryan Shrout, you can head over to pcpur.com because that's where all of Ryan Shrout is located. And Alan Malventano and Ken and Jeremy and the rest of the crew are bringing you all of the hardware news as fast as they can. Can we expect a 1070 Ti review on the 26th? Or should we just, you know, assume that they're just automatically going to ship all of the cards directly to the Bitcoin miners.
probably the second miners. One, yeah. Why would they ship us a review sample? It doesn't matter. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I could be right. My theory, I have a theory that they've been stockpiling 1070 Ti's. So they'll have enough for the currency miners and for consumers just to piss me off because I bought a 1070 2 months ago. With that obnoxious note, ladies and gentlemen, you can find all of our older episodes of Twitch at twit.tv/twich, including links to the RSS feeds if you want to automate the downloads, which we highly suggest you do so you don't miss an episode. And this is your first episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. We thank you for joining us. We hope you go to twit.tv/twitch to get the downloads on your favorite podcast listening device. And we want to thank you all for listening. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Gorton.
I'm Ryan Shrum.
See you next week on Twitch.